Going to be studying tonight from the fourth chapter of the book of James. You might be taking your Bibles and turning there with me. James and the writing of this book, he of course is the brother, one of the two New Testament writings, that is the brother of our Lord, the other being Jude. He has a bit of an insight of things that, in fact, I think that his brother in the flesh would intend for those to whom he's writing to have a clear understanding. James is going to approach the things about which he's going to be discussing in a very practical way. It's one of the things that I like about the book of James. You have a significant amount of depth within it, and what you're going to have here is enough information that's going to be able to scan the scope of those that have different levels of Bible knowledge, where you're coming from the novice all the way to the veteran. But in the midst of it all, you're going to be able to see, particularly like what you're finding in chapter 4, some very practical admonitions for every one of us as children of God. In the chapter, he's going to address things like the problems that have to do with covetousness. He's going to deal with the problem of prayer and making sure that there is a proper approach that we make unto God in respect of prayer. He's going to deal with the contrast that exists between pride and humility. That'll be undertaken in the writing. A little bit about worldliness. And there are other issues. One of the appeals you might remember that he makes in chapter 4 is that in resisting the devil we should do that, and then drawing nigh unto God. You remember all of these particulars that are found within the writing of chapter 4 of the book of James. And then he's going to end it up, as you're going to find in the last section, as you begin with me, if you would, at about verse 13, and we'll go to the end of the chapter. James writes this. He says, "Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we'll go into such a city, and stay there a year, buy and sell and get gain." And then James is going to state this, "Whereas ye know not what shall be on tomorrow, for what is your life? It is but a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. For that you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. But now you rejoice in your boastings, and all such rejoicing is evil. Therefore, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin." Most occasions, I would imagine that we have a tendency to take that passage, and particularly in verse 17, and remove it from the rest of the context. You cannot do that. We usually spend a great deal of time on occasion in our study of the book of James and centering in on that sentiment that is found in verse 17. "Him that knoweth to do good doeth it not, to him it is sin." We'll go across that and we'll just kind of breeze over it, and we'll make an issue about that for just a little bit. But you have to take into account the first word of the passage. The first word establishes a conclusion. Therefore. And so we need not forget exactly how this attaches itself to what else is found within that text. I want us to make sure that we understand what it is that James is telling those people then. Because what he is stating is one of the things I pointed out yesterday, is the reason for the selection of the lessons that we use. There are times when I enter into gospel meetings, I like to be able to use things that are very timely, especially in circumstances considering our climate of culture now, and seeing how that these things affect even those among us in the kingdom of Christ. I perceive that this is a very significant problem, as what he's addressing here. It's not a new one, obviously, because the writer James is dealing with it here. The brethren to whom he's writing are having a problem with making sure that God is involved in the plans they make. And he's going to illustrate this with the use of the example that he has. I want to take opportunity for just a few minutes and just examine some of the, just a synopsis, if you please, of the example that he uses and how practical it is for us to examine it. Take, for example, for just a moment, he's going to mention, first of all, "Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such a city, stay there a year, buy and sell and get gain." Here you've got some merchants that are obviously interested in going to some other place other than where they are presently to carry out their business venture. They're working on a time plan and a time frame as to how long they're going to be there. They have stated definitively as to what they intend for their goal to be. And now when you take this into consideration, there is also a number of issues that have to go into what they're planning. So think about it for just a minute. We're not certain, as it's not revealed to us, as to exactly how far away this place would have been. And do bear in mind, please, that when James offers this illustration, it's almost parabolic in its form, that it's like unto a parable. And we get confused on occasion when we talk about the parables of Jesus. We think of them as being somewhat fantastic stories of some sort. They're rather fantasies or more like myths. And that's not the case at all. The parables that Jesus offered in his teachings, incidentally, were things that either did happen or could happen. And you have to keep that in mind. And what it is that James is doing here is relating an example himself of something about which he knows and these other people that are hearing it can easily relate to it. So now if there are those, as I'm sure it is with any of you, if any of you are business people, Larry and I were talking a little while ago about some of the business ventures that he would have to take in going out in Nevada and other places and carrying out his business. Well, there are a number of things that we may have to undertake in order to do something of that nature. And it's more involved then than it even is now. I mean, if I want to do a little business in Memphis, say, for example, I crawl in my pickup or I get in my van and I head off to Memphis. I'm there in 2 hours. I can do my business and come back if that's the case. Not then. You didn't do that then. What you're talking about during this particular period of time, if you're living in the area of Jerusalem and if you've got business that you've got to take care of up in Ephesus, then that means that you're going to have to make whatever plans that you need to make to cross the land between there and, say, Joppa or Tyre, where you might be able to catch a boat here and make the trip across the Mediterranean and then up the Aegean Sea some piece and then be able to embark there and then go in inland to be able to catch into Ephesus to find out what it is that you might need to be doing there. If, in fact, that you're going to be going east from Jerusalem, most of what you're going to be involved here is either going by foot, horseback, muleback, whatever the case may be there, but that's mostly going across the land. Now, all of this has to play a role in the plans that these men are going to make. Now, we don't know, as I stated, as exactly which way that they're going to go. We know that they have selected a particular place, but now every bit of the planning has to go into this. If, in fact, I've got to make the plans to go off to Joppa to hit a boat over here, that means I've got to either walk that distance, take the mule or horseback, which means now all the materials that I've got to have in the business that I'm going to be involved in, if I'm going to take a mule or a horse, I've got to have provender for him or them. I've got to make sure that I've got things for myself and the others that are with me to eat and drink. I've got to make sure that on the way there, that there are safe places for me to encamp, or if there is an inn somewhere that I can... Can you see how all this adds up? So now we're thinking about this, then let's just kind of get into the particulars as to what all's involved in the stay. Now these people, particularly Jews, were very familiar with travel. I mean, just coming into the land of Canaan was 40 years of it after they left Egypt. But they were very familiar with it from the standpoint of even after coming into the land, and eventually you remember Jacob had assigned his sons the different areas where their tribes would be set. Let's just say that you were of the tribe of Issachar. You're up in the northwestern section of the area of Palestine. Knowing what the law stated concerning the use of, or the visitation of the feast, you had to go to the Passover, but you had to attend at least two of the feasts of the major ones. If you're living up in the area of Issachar, you have to make that travel all the way down into Jerusalem to attend the feast, and then there's the trip back. Not to say if you happen to be one of those that happen to live over in the areas of Asia Minor or Europe. You imagine what it was like for them during the time when the law of Moses was still in effect. I mean, if you happen to live in Ephesus, you're going to have to take a boat or something of this nature, unless you're going to take the road to come around Asia Minor and go around the Mediterranean. You're talking about months of travel. You get down there to Jerusalem. You have the Passover feast. The Pentecost is 50 days later. That's almost 2 months later. And then after it's over, then make the trip and go all the way back. You're away from home 5 or 6 months just to attend two feasts. These people were very familiar with the concept of travel and all that was going to be involved with it. And here you got these merchants that are involved in a business venture here. Note the particulars. So it starts. The time of their departure. That's the first thing they got to consider. Today or tomorrow. Now, what that indicates here is they're uncertain at this particular point as to when they're going to be ready to leave. And notice also there's the first person plural here, so it's not just one of these fellows, it's more than one. So it indicates that there may be one of them ready to go, but the other may not be, or the others may not be. And with all the things that they have to gather together to be ready to make this trip, all that stuff has to be brought together. And if they happen to have it before nightfall, they might be able to get a few miles behind them. But if not, then they'll get up early in the morning and they'll head out. But it's today or tomorrow. Today or tomorrow, we will go to such a city. So now there is a particular destination that becomes part of the discussion. As is stated, we don't know exactly where it would be, but now we have to look at this from the standpoint of James making his point here. It didn't really make any difference where it was. It is obviously not where they were. They were going somewhere else. And the decision that they had made as to where it was they were going to go, I'm sure, is based upon what other businessmen would do. They would probably talk to other businessmen that had been coming in the area where they presently would be. What's it like over here? Is the business culture good and right for the things that we're expecting to do and what we intend to achieve? And they would either tell them yes or no. And on the basis of their studies or past experiences, then that decision would be made. And so now the destination has been determined. But then, go to such a city. The third is the length of our stay. So now they have to make a determination as to how long they're going to stay in this place. As they discuss this amongst themselves, based again on past experiences, they may realize with the business that they are in that this particular location is something that's going to be ripe for their business for about a period of a year. So that's now been determined. And then they utter their particular goal. We will buy and sell and get gain. We're going to make money here. And what they're offering here as they're discussing this is something that is undertaken by commerce even this very day. You sell low or buy low, sell higher, get the profit. You buy wholesale, sell retail, you take the profit of that, take care of everything as far as your overhead is concerned, and what's left from that, that's what you put in the pocket, and that's what you live on. You say, now, preacher, why is it that you're going through all this? For one primary reason. Consider the story. Consider the example. Why it is that James brings this to their attention, and then you consider this question. In all of what it was that they were planning, is God mentioned in the plan? No. And that's the reason why he's addressing this. God was not in the plan. And that's the reason why it is he's going to undertake a discussion with these Christians. You need to be very mindful about how you approach, how you plan to do something. How many of you made the statement this evening, I'm going to be at Oak Ridge tonight? You stated that with a definitive statement, didn't you? How many of you in the process of stating that, if the Lord's will, I plan to be at Oak Ridge tonight? You see, on many occasions, we have a tendency to be just as typical in what we say in definitive nature as these people did during that time. And the writer James is warning us we need never do that. And you talk about the seriousness of it all as to why that's the case. He's going to help us understand all of that. So what's the problem with it? It's presumptuousness. You ever studied and talked about presumptuousness? It's something that the Bible is going to speak a little bit about. If you want to define it from the English dictionary, you'll find it a couple of different definitions. One of them is to take for granted. The other is the word suppose. You might suppose something. But the other is a definition that more relates to what we're talking about here. It's to act or proceed with unwarrantable or impertinent boldness. In spite of what you do not know, you have come to a conclusion and you base your action upon really what you don't know. And how many times do we do that? We assume too many things. Well, you know, David knows a little bit about this. I figure David had a little problem with presumptuousness, don't you figure? You take in consideration for just a little bit some of the actions that he took during the course of his life, especially with the situation with Bathsheba. I have a feeling he was a little presumptuous in some things here. He's presuming, number one, that nobody really knows or cares anything about it. The fact that he's a king, nobody's really going to do anything about what it is that he's going to do where Bathsheba's concerned. And so he goes ahead with it. He tries to hide the situation, presuming that that's going to take care of the matter. His presumption is wrong. He was presumptuous in his dealing with Ahithophel and so many others. And we don't have time to go into all of these things. But he does know a little bit about it. In Psalm 19, he spoke about it just a bit. Would you like, I believe it's about verse 13, is where it was that he mentioned, "Keep back thy servant from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me." I think he had been overwhelmed on occasions by the use of his own presumptuousness. He understands the danger of such a thing like this. And when he was going through the actions as he was with Bathsheba, it was obvious that God was not in the plan in dealing with her. He had developed a plan. He called for her to come to him. He didn't have to do that. But he did. And even when she came, he could have told her, "You don't need to be outside bathing yourself in the view of anybody else." Did he do that? No, he didn't do that either. So that's the reason why that you're seeing this is a calculated thing that he's doing in bringing her there. It's all in the plan, and he has made the decision from this point as to what he's going to do, and he does it and ends up with a child that comes from this illicit relationship, and then all the problems begin to snowball from there. Well, there you consider some other things that have to do with what we're seeing here. These gentlemen, about whom we're speaking here in James chapter 4, watch the presumption that's found within the text. Today or tomorrow, look at the words now. We will go. Today or tomorrow, we will go. Now that's stated definitively, isn't it? There's no sense of ambiguity to it. There's no sense of doubt about what their intention is going to be. It's either by the time we get through putting together things this evening, we'll leave, but no later than tomorrow, we will go. You know, you listen to these fellows speak like this, even the entirety of what it is they're saying. If you're a businessman, you say, well, you know, it's rather noble what it is they're stating. And on top of that, you can hear the determination in their voice. These fellows are driven to succeed. Who wouldn't want to have somebody like this involved in their business? These guys are driven to succeed. The only problem with all of this is that sense of definitiveness in which they have made this claim is what it is that makes it serious to where James now has to deal with it. And so now you look at what he does is he's going to insert here a little dose of reality. These fellows have stated definitively, we will go. When? Either today or tomorrow, we will go. And James says, wait a minute. He says, fellas, you don't even know what's coming tomorrow. You don't even know what's going to come through the course of the day, much less tomorrow. You don't know what a day's going to bring. Solomon added to that too, Proverbs chapter 27, you remember in verse 1, boast not thyself of tomorrow, because you don't know what a day may bring. They weren't even through with this day yet. How is it that they could state definitively that they would leave that evening or the next day when they don't know precisely as to what's going to happen? You know, my parents, March 24th, 2011, I know their intention was by that afternoon was to go fishing. It never crossed their mind that there would be a fellow that would take their life that day. My mother is stabbed in the chest. My father is stabbed in the neck. They never would have thought about the day starting with something like that happening in mind. Their intention was to go fishing that afternoon. Well, you say, now, was God in their planning? It was always part of their plan. I went a couple of months later to my father's office to begin to clean it out. I look on his desk. He's working on a sermon. He just started. He had the introduction. You know what the title of the lesson was? Will I Die Today? Tell me God was not in his planning. He had planned all his life for the time that he would depart. Mom had done the same. But they didn't start that day with that in mind. What's the point? That's what James is telling these people. You're talking about definitively that today or tomorrow you're going to go someplace and you have the audacity to say you're going to be there a year. You have no clue. You don't know whether you're going to make it out the building this evening or not. I could die up here in the pulpit. That's happened before. We don't have a clue as to when all of these things are going to take place. But to say something with such definitiveness, somebody says, no, wait a minute, is it the fact that James is saying we need never make plans? No, he's not saying that at all. You go out throughout the Bible, you're going to find example after example of people making plans and doing things. What is his point? Don't leave God out of the plan. What's so difficult? That's the reason for his admonition right here. You don't know what a day's going to bring. And in addition to all of this, he helps them to understand what the point is by making this point. And you've heard this a number of times. He's going to ask a question, which is one of the most profound questions that has ever been asked. And the fact of the matter is that there are volumes upon volumes of books that have been written about what is stated in the passage. But what he's addressing right here is really not a philosophical question. It's just straightforward. He's dealing about what things have to do with your physical life. Now, you can look at it in a physical, logical fashion if that's what you want to do. And like I say, there are all kinds of books on things like that. The question is, what is your life? Wasn't there an old program a long time ago, What Is Your Life? Wasn't that on TV some years ago? You know, basically what it had to do with is what a person did for a living. People had to guess what they did. What is your life? James is making it very clear. He says, I want you to put this in perspective in your thinking. I want you to think about your physical existence for just this minute. What is your life? So now he's going to tell them. In case they had a problem in perceiving it, he says it is but a vapor. Here is your perspective. It is but a vapor. years ago. I remember when I was at Free Arvin. You had a number of students that were starting to come in from different countries, foreign students come in. And we had one from Nigeria. And I remember them talking about him, those that were his caretakers, when they brought him in, and this was in 1972. This was, I guess, the second semester when I was there. It was in 1972 when he came. And they brought him into New York, and he gets off the plane in New York. It's cold outside. He has never seen his breath before. That's the first time he ever saw his breath. It scared him to death because he thought his insides were on fire. You can kind of see something like this, but now I want you to bear in mind exactly what he saw, just as you see it. When you go outside and you breathe that, when it's in cold air, that warm air from your body reaches it, and it's there for the moment, and then it's gone. In perspective of the existence of the life that exists here upon the earth, that's the way that our life is in comparison. It's just that little dot of existence. Day with the Lord's a thousand years is a day, but we have no concept of really understanding that. And somebody like Methuselah could give us some insight about what it'd be like to be almost a thousand years old. But he didn't make it. And no one else that we know of has any concept of knowing that. Ours is just a little vapor. Even Peter talked about it. He used a different example in 1 Peter in chapter 1 in verse 24. He talked about, and this is a verse that you've heard a number of times if you've been in funerals. All flesh is as grass. The glory of man is the flower of grass. The grass withereth and the flower thereof, it falls away. You know, grass goes through its cycle, doesn't it? You know, when the freeze comes, the grass turns brown, and we essentially say about it that it's dead. But when the warm weather comes back around, you will see the regeneration of it. It's gone through its cycle, and now the roots are beginning to produce the chlorophyll again that begins to bring the grass back out of the ground and green again. And if it's allowed to go uncut for a while, you remember, it'll produce seed, and it'll even reproduce itself. Man is like that. We go through cycle. We come forth from mother's womb. We live to a point. We marry. We procreate. There's other seed that comes from all of this. And then we pass. And then the next generation will do it. It's just the cycle of life. And it's just for a short period of time. There are those that are of the opinion that they're going to be able to cheat death for some reason or the other. They think their money is going to keep them from happening. Turn back, if you would, with me to James chapter 1. Let's read together a statement that he makes here at verses 10 and 11. James makes a point here, says, "Now, but the rich in that he's made low, because as the flower of grass, he shall pass away. For the sun is no sooner risen with the burning heat, but it withereth the grass, and the flower thereof falleth, and the grace of the fashion of it perisheth. So also shall the rich man fade away in his ways." Rich man's not going to be able to use what he's got to be able to overcome and cheat death. It's not going to happen. It's going to come to each and every one of us. I often wondered about the thinking of Solomon. Solomon is considered probably the richest man that's ever lived on the planet. I don't have time to go through all of what he stated. I'll just kind of paraphrase it a bit, but you look at it if you like. You go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Ecclesiastes, book of Ecclesiastes is like an inspired autobiography of Solomon. He tells us a little bit about what it is that he did and why he thought during this particular time. "Anything that my eyes wanted, I did not withhold a thing from myself. If I wanted a vineyard, I planted it. If I wanted an orchard, I planted it. If I wanted man singers, women singers, musical instruments, if I had houses, then I built houses. I built everything that you could imagine. I had it all." And coming into it, you're going down to the text, and he makes this statement. "And I was great." Didn't he? And he thinks of himself about how he thought during that particular period of time. Go on down through the text, and this is what he's going to ultimately say. "I began to think about all of it," he states. "And I came to a conclusion that every bit of it and my way of life during that time did not have God in my life like I should have? What was he replacing God with, incidentally? Nothing against women. Don't get me wrong. But when you bring 1,000 women into your household, you deserve every problem you get. I guess that's the reason why it is he only lived 66 years. Can you imagine? But the reason why I'm mentioning that is simply because of the fact that the women themselves were mostly ungodly people, and God warned them, you need to leave these people alone. And that's exactly what led him away. Do you think in all these things that he was talking about, building the houses, the buildings, the orchards, all the elements that he brought into the house, the instruments and everything, he planned in all of this, was God in the plan? You could see the problem. Just because of the fact that he may have been the richest man didn't mean that this is going to eliminate his problems. What about the rich farmer of Luke chapter 12? Got many goods laid up for many years. Sit down, eat, drink, be merry. Thou fool. This night shall thy soul be required of thee. Then who shall these things be that thou hast provided? Somebody else will have them by the time the morning comes. God wasn't in the plan. How many of us have been of this very same disposition? Even as businessmen or not, made a trip like these fellows here, and without making the plans, let's say, for example, if I'm going to be gone for a week or two on a business trip, even if let's just say I'm going to take a vacation, how many of us sit down and look over what it is we're going to do? And one of the first things that needs to come to my mind is there a congregation, a faithful congregation of the Lord's church in this area? And am I going to find out what time the services are going to be so I make sure that if I'm there at the time of the services, that I'm going to be where I ought to be? How many of us take vacations and we go places where Christians ought not be seen or go? God's not in the plan. How many of us make these business trips and do such things where God's not in the planning? And when the business trip involves going to some place where the people with whom we're going to be involved, well, we're going to go over to this particular bar or something of this nature, or and if we find out that these are the things that are going to be happening, do we tell these people, I'm sorry, but I don't do that kind of business? Is God in our planning? Do we make that kind of decision? You see, we can't see what's ahead of us. There's only really three or four things that you can determine as far as our future is concerned. The Bible tells us a future is only limited, just as we've noted in the text. And we know certainly, Hebrews 9:27, that there's going to be death. We know that's coming. We know in John chapter 5, 28 and 29, that there's going to be a resurrection. And we know as we go back to Hebrews 9 and verse 27, there's going to be a judgment. These are the only things that we can be definitively sure about. Other than that, we can't be definitively sure about anything as far as the future is concerned. And you know we know that. But you know what our problem is? We don't like to acknowledge that. And we make our decisions and we state things definitively in spite of what we don't know. Let me use an illustration, and I'll make the lesson yours. I want to ask you a question or two. Have you ever thought much about the situation of the people of Noah's day? Have you ever wondered about the reaction? What did these people, let me ask it like this, what did those people in Noah's day think in respect to his preaching? You say, was he preaching? Yes. You remember Peter had stated he was a preacher of righteousness. He preached for those 120 years while he was preparing the ark. I figure one of the primary points of his preaching had to do with the principle of repentance, because the world was lying in wickedness in that time. Every thought was evil continually. So this would have to be some of the things that Noah was going to be addressing. What do you think they thought about his preaching? Probably not a whole lot, because it's evident the fact that they didn't repent, right? So this next question. What did they know as juxtaposed against what they thought they knew? What did they think they know? They thought they knew that Noah was crazy. But they didn't know what he's talking about. God's going to destroy the world by flood. Nothing like that's ever happened before. He's going to bring rain. Nothing like that's happened before. So they're thinking nothing like this is going to happen. But what did Noah know? He knew what God told him because he was receptive to everything that God had stated up to this point, the reason why he finds favor with him. He knows what's coming, and that's the reason he's building the ark. Now, my final question is this. What was the difference? Was God in Noah's planning? Oh, yeah. And what difference did that make? He's the only one that survives. That's the difference it made. And when you go back and you look at this statement that you're finding right here in James chapter 4, let's go back just a second. I don't have time to go through some other details here, but I want to end up on that last statement that you find in the chapter. After he goes through all of this, talking about, you know, here's the disposition you're showing at this particular point. You're rejoicing and you're boasting. Oh, you're talking so big and so definitively about where it is that you're going and that you're going to make money. You're going to succeed when you're there. All fine and good, but that kind of rejoicing, he says, is evil. Therefore, James says, here's my conclusion. To him that knoweth to do good, what's the good? Now, you can incorporate any number of things that you want in that passage to make a lesson out of it. But hit the context. What's the good? You know what it is. Is make sure that God's in every plan. That's it. And to him that knoweth to do good and doesn't do it, what? Him is sin. Now that's powerful, in my view. That puts a different perspective, it should, on our life. I preach on this from time to time. I study this all the time, but I still find myself, I have to confess this fact, that even in the plans that I make or in the statements that I make about something that I'm going to do, I will catch myself on occasion sometime later. You know, I'm going to do this and I'm going to that. I'm going to be here or be there. And I don't make this acknowledgement, if the Lord will. And he emphasizes that point that you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. It may not be that it is. So I don't need to speak definitively about it outside the will that he knows or has for me. That's found within his will. That which is written here, I can follow it. I can do what he says. I can have some confidence about what I plan to do because I'm going to put him first in the decisions that I make. If the Lord will, I'll live and do this or that. Time is coming when life will pass us, and we don't know how it's coming. Some of us have had sicknesses and we've escaped it temporarily. But it's still going to catch up with us. At some point in time, there's going to be this departure. James is telling us it could come at any point. Accidents happen all the time. Their graveyards are full of people who thought they would live on and on and on. The whole point he's trying to make is always be prepared. If you're here tonight and you haven't obeyed the gospel of Christ, it's high time that you get prepared. Time for preparations now. You know not what shall be on the morrow. You don't know what a day may bring forth. So be prepared. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, act upon it, please. Faith without works is dead, so you've got to do something with the faith you have. You got to turn away from sin. Jesus says, you can't serve me. You're not going to be able to enter heaven if you continue to walk the path of sinfulness, so you're going to have to turn away from that. You're going to have to confess my name, Jesus states, before man with a mouth. This unto salvation, Paul says in Romans 10. You're going to have to put me on in baptism, Galatians 3 and 27, that you might be saved in Mark 16, 16, so that you can have remission and of your sins, to have them washed away, Acts 2, Acts 22. And if perhaps you haven't done that, you've got an opportunity to do it tonight because time is passing. If you have and you've departed from the Lord and His way, you need to reconcile. It's with Him. If it's a private affair, keep it between you and Him. If it's something that's reproached the body of Christ, you need to clarify that with the brethren and reconcile with them as well. We sing a song to urge your obedience tonight. There'll be somebody here to assist you and help you if that need exists. Won't you if you need to? While we stand, while we sing the song.